And we're here.
Oh my goodness.
Heyo.
We are here.
We are.
This is the Baylor College of Medicine Residence Podcast. I am one of your hosts, Eric Anderson.
And I'm another host, Brandon Garcia.
I'm Jennifer.
I'm Carl. I'm another writer.
I'm Dan. I'm just here.
Dan is also a writer.
You're very important.
So this is a very, I guess, relevant episode that we decided to put out kind of on the fly to do a quick COVID-19 information, like what is the newest in the literature.
Coronavirus.
The coronavirus, to try to get it to your ears and kind of point you in the direction if you want to learn more about it. So we're going to just kind of go through talking first about a little bit of background, what are the coronaviruses, and then the a little bit of epidemiology, pathogenesis, and some of the current treatment options and maybe some future ones that we'll be seeing. So
yeah, so basically we're all quarantined just like everyone else right now, can't do much. And we decided we wanted to talk about the coronavirus and see what we could explain to you guys.
And before we start, I'd just like to mention something very important. We are medical students. We are not licensed medical personnel. And so everything that we are about to tell you is what we have learned from our research and, you know, from, you know, some of our own just understanding of everything. But know that if you are feeling like you're having any symptoms of any sort of like cough or fever, you should call your doctor. And
we're medical students. We know as much as a little bit more than maybe the public because we're in it, but that doesn't mean we should be like your ultimate source of understanding what's going on. We definitely encourage you to go through, read the material. We will have it posted so that you can be able to see what it is that we read through and realize this is an ongoing situation, meaning it's constantly changing. Information is going to change and update, and things are going to be different 10 months from now than they are right this moment.
Yeah, that's a good point. We're going to make it so that all of our references are available on the website.
Yep.
So, Jenny, do you want
to start? Yeah, so I'm going to talk about the terminology because coronavirus, COVID, SARS can be kind of confusing. But coronavirus is the most general term. So coronaviruses are just a group of viruses that can cause respiratory disease in humans. And you might have heard of severe acute respiratory syndrome coronavirus or SARS coronavirus, also called SARS or also called SARS-CoV-1. That caused a outbreak in 2002. And then MERS-CoV is another kind of coronavirus that caused an outbreak in 2012. But now we're on to SARS-CoV-2, and that is what causes COVID-19. But now people kind of use the terms interchangeably, so they might use COVID-19 to just refer to the virus itself. Or they might just say coronavirus. So that's what we're dealing with now.
I actually remember as a kid, my family was really big on watching the news. I remember being like, you said 2002, so I was like 10 or 11. And I remember them talking about SARS and it being a big deal. So it's kind of, it feels like an instance of history repeating itself right now.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the big distinguishing factor was that the SARS-CoV-1 outbreak, the 2002 outbreak, never really got too far outside of Asia, the original site. And so it spread to a few countries. It spread, you know, from mainland China to Hong Kong and so on and so forth, but it didn't go worldwide like we're seeing now.
Yeah, and we'll talk a little bit about why that probably is actually pretty soon.
Yeah. So just a little bit about how this virus started from what we think. So patient zero seems to have come from a seafood market in Wuhan. There were 27 cases of a pretty bad viral pneumonia that were reported mostly from one specific market. And this was a market where they sold live poultry and snakes and bats and other kinds of wildlife animals. And when they look at the DNA, or the RNA actually, because this is an RNA virus, when they look at the genetic makeup of this coronavirus, it looks like it's a combination of a bat coronavirus and like it has some snake coronavirus elements as well. Hmm. So it seems the wrong bat met up with the wrong snake, perhaps at this market.
And this was in December of 2019, right? Yeah, which is how it got the 2019 designation, or the 19 designation.
Mm-hmm. So this is some kind of bat-snake thing.
Bat-snake thing. But also, there's no evidence that COVID-19 infects cats or dogs. So for now, don't be worried about, you know, your little fluffy companions.
I just think it's interesting because, like, from like a viral epidemiology standpoint, like, this happens every year with the flu.
Mm-hmm.
You know, flu seems to rearrange itself fairly frequently by this interaction between species, and when you have a virus that can jump between multiple species, and this seems to be another case of it. It's just wrong virus at the wrong time, hooking up in a weird snake bar thing.
I think you are right, Brandon, pointing out that with these zoonotic pathogens, which are pathogens that have large components of their genetic code that come from animals, it's really like a perfect storm because our bodies aren't really used to it or familiar to it, right? So we don't have good defenses for it. Plus, it's not well adapted to us, which means it might be a lot more toxic to us, even though that's not really efficient for the transmission of the virus or the bacteria.
I think this is important to talk about because it's a key thing to understand that this isn't like a man-made virus. It wasn't something created in the lab, or it's not some kind of bioterrorism thing gone wrong. It's just the product of high population density, both of animals and humans living together.
Yeah, and so to just move on to talking about a little bit about the epidemiology, one of the first big studies that came out February 24th was by the Chinese CDC, and they did a study of about 44,000 confirmed COVID-19 cases and found a case fatality of 2.3%. The case fatality is the number of deaths per confirmed cases. So 2.3% would be 23 people in 1,000 would die if they were infected. And then they also kind of stratified the population that it infected, but we'll be talking about that a little bit more later. And a very recent study actually just came out that was looking at this percentage a little bit more closely and kind of commenting that a lot of these numbers that you might see thrown around for other countries and places are actually difficult to really get a straight answer about because it's an ongoing situation. And so you might have a number of confirmed cases, but it takes 2 to 3 weeks to know what the outcome was. So that can kind of lead to some skewing. And then also, if you're not testing all asymptomatic people, which we're definitely not, that's going to skew the numbers. So with all that being said, another team kind of looked at a smaller cohort and found, trying to account for some of these variables, found that the case fatality rate was really more like 1.8%, which is not to say that it's still not a serious thing. And just to give you some reference, influenza has a case fatality of 0.0024%. So the point being, it's still serious and it's still an issue. One of the reasons why this is so kind of causing the pandemic that it is it's sort of at this sweet spot of infectious, but also still being carried by a lot of asymptomatic people. And, you know, whereas SARS had a case fatality rate of like 14 to 15%, and that's what people think is why it wasn't able to spread as much, because it was too deadly. And so it couldn't be maintained in the host. And I don't know if you want to talk about the R-naught and kind of what that is.
Yeah. So R-naught is a concept in epidemiology that's supposed to estimate how many people will you give a virus or, you know, disease if you have it. So the R-naught for this virus is between 2 and 3.5, meaning that if one person is infected with COVID, they will give it to about 2 or 3 people on average.
In contrast to that, measles is, if one person infects, they're probably going to spread it to 9.
Yeah, measles is super contagious. And then what, I had the flu in here.
I think the flu is like 3 or 5, somewhere
really?
In that region.
I thought it was less than
seasonal
COVID.
Flu, I think, is maybe slightly like over one. So it's like maybe
really?
1.1, 1.3, I think, typically. It depends on the strain, right?
Where's our fact checker?
When we're vaccinated, right, I think it's actually less than one. That's why vaccines are so important, right? That's the important thing about R-naught. It's modifiable by our behaviors and actions, which is the whole point of the flatten the curve.
Yeah. And they think COVID might be a little more contagious than, say, the flu, because there's a longer incubation time. So you could have it and not know for like a week or so, and you're just, you know, living your life, touching your eye and then touching like things at the grocery store, etc., and spreading it to people without knowing it.
Yeah, and I think that's probably a good transition into the pathogenesis to talk a little bit about how is this spread, and you know, a little bit more detail of molecular physiology.
You mean it's time to get up close and personal with the coronavirus?
You could say that.
So coronavirus is pretty interesting. There's actually a lot of different strains of coronavirus that have kind of not very close relation to each other. This one obviously is relatively new to the human population. It is a very large single-stranded positive sense RNA virus. It's about 30 kilobases, which for an RNA virus is actually on the larger side. The reason it's called coronavirus is because it has a crown-like appearance when you look at it under the microscope. It basically has these little spikes that stick out of it, which some old guy way back in the day thought looked like a crown. And then there's a Latin word for crown that's corona-like, so they said coronavirus. The spike proteins on the virus, there's actually two specific types, S1 and S2. The S1 proteins are the ones that are used to usually grab on to your cells to help infect, facilitate infection. And actually it's been talked about the receptor used by those cells is ACE2, which is angiotensin-converting enzyme receptor 2. Because there's multiple types of ACE receptors. And it's pretty interesting because that's also a target for certain blood pressure medications and things. So that's a physiologically important receptor that it uses to dock onto the cells. There's also another peptide on there in the spikes called the S2, which helps for fusion of the virus into the cell. So you have those two basic spikes. Their whole point is to just get the virus into the cell. Once it's in the cell, the virus does its thing, which basically means it hijacks your cell's machinery to make a whole bunch of copies of itself, which then it can launch out into your body to spread the infection. Very complex pathogenic mechanism by this virus. It does seem to, more so than other coronaviruses, really target the respiratory system. We're not sure why. And when we say respiratory system, we really mean the lower respiratory system. So usually we divide into the upper respiratory system, which you can kind of think is things above the neck, you know, in the neck and the head, and then the lower, which is like in the chest, which is the lungs for the most part. That's the big thing for the lower respiratory system. And this is where coronavirus really likes to attack. So yeah, like as far as transmission, we had different classifications, right, that are official classifications. Right now we are certain that this is what's called droplet. It has droplet transmission, which means relatively large droplets of water that come out when you cough, sneeze, spit, can carry the virus a decent distance, probably at least about 6 feet before falling to the ground. That's the whole social distancing, keep 6 feet away. There is some discussion about whether or not it can stay in the air for longer, which would be considered more like airborne type transmission. That's an ongoing area of research.
But better to assume it's airborne and it not be airborne than assume it's not airborne and it is.
Yeah.
So wear masks. You look cool.
It seems to cause major illness by triggering possibly an overactive immune response. There's a lot of intermediaries involved in this process. We think one important one is interleukin-6 called IL-6, but there's a lot of other intermediaries. We can get something called a cytokine storm actually happening, where just a whole bunch of immunomodulatory chemicals are released into the body and it causes lots of issues. They haven't gotten a lot of chances yet to see what this thing looks like, what a person's lungs look like in an active infection. But it's interesting, there was one case study where two infected patients were incidentally examined in China. They actually were people who went in for lobectomies to have part of their lungs cut out because they had lung cancer, and they just happened to be infected, and they noticed and they got to look. And they did see that it seemed like in both of these patients there was a lot of edema in the lungs, which is basically swelling up. A lot of congestion of the blood vessels, once again, is kind of like swelling, filling with fluid. There is what we call exudate filling up the lungs, which is a pretty common thing when you have a process called a pneumonia.
I was just thinking it's important for us to also make the disclaimer. We are not licensed medical professionals, just to reiterate, we are medical students. So everything that we're telling you right now is what we have found from, you know, our literature search of the scientific literature. But if you are feeling any symptoms that you think are alarming, then you should call your doctor.
That's a good point. We talked a little bit about how coronavirus is spread and transmitted and what it kind of does in a more scientific or detailed way in the body. But what are the general signs and symptoms that you kind of notice clinically? Like when a person walks into a hospital or if you yourself are feeling ill, what should you be looking out for? So there is a wide spectrum of symptoms with this thing. That's one of the things that's tricky about it. As Eric has said, people can be asymptomatic and have no symptoms but still have the virus. People can have very mild symptoms. People can have really bad symptoms like organ failure, you know, respiratory failure. So wide spectrum. Of the people that are symptomatic, we've noticed, seems like the consensus is starting to form that about 80% will have what we call mild symptoms. So these are people that are typically going to be okay if they just stay at home, isolate, make sure they don't spread the disease to other people, and just kind of treat this like a normal bout of the flu, right? So those people could have lots of symptoms. Fever is the most consistent one. So most of the people that get coronavirus have some form of fever. How severe the fever is varies, but most of the people with symptoms will have a fever. Next most common symptom is a cough, a dry cough, right? Which means there's not usually that much sputum. You can also have things like fatigue, malaise, sinus congestion, a runny nose, a sore throat, body aches, very rarely diarrhea. So you'll kind of just have a lot of general flu-like symptoms with a big focus on cough and fever. That's about 80% of people. Then you have 15% of people, roughly, who are said to have like severe illness. And looking around, it seems like the agreement with severe illness, mostly what characterizes severe illness is it does interfere with a person's ability to breathe in some way, right? So either the people have difficulty breathing or the oxygen saturation in their blood decreases. And that gets us to the 5% of people who have what's called critical illness. And critical illness is defined as people who have either respiratory failure, something called septic shock, or some sort of organ dysfunction or organ failure, right? And these people are very sick. A lot of these people, their lungs just aren't working at all. And the only way we can really keep them going is to stick in something like a ventilator, which breathes for them essentially to try to keep them oxygenated. That's about 5% of people. And that is like really concerning because that requires a lot of medical equipment, a lot of staff, a lot of attention. And that's what we're really worried about with flattening the curve, is trying to make it so fewer people get to that level of illness, which then won't strain our medical system as much. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So usually for people, they start the illness with mild symptoms, but for some patients, they can start right away with breathing dysfunction. The patients that start right away with problems breathing tend to be people who are older or have pre-existing comorbidities, what we call them, so other conditions in addition to the virus.
Like people who have heart problems, people who are supremely overweight, those kind of deals.
Yeah. Like it could be a variety of underlying conditions, basically. Yeah. That's where you do hear about people with like cardiovascular issues or lung issues. For most people, though, they have the mild symptoms. For a certain percentage of patients, after about 1 week, could be more or less, all of a sudden they can have a rapid worsening of the illness where they start struggling to breathe. One of the most concerning signs I came across when I was reading, they said, was once the patient starts having difficulty breathing on their own in any way, or once their oxygen saturation starts to go down in any way, that's when you really need to keep an eye on them, because then they can take a massive turn for the worse, go into the critical illness state where they can't breathe on their own. And that's when you really need to make sure you get on top of that and intubate or ventilate to keep them going. All right. As far as making a diagnosis, a lot of this stuff is diagnosed just by doctors clinically, meaning they look at the pattern of symptoms and they say, this looks like what's going on. Then we can confirm by testing for presence of the virus, right? There are a couple of imaging results that are indicative, but they're not super specific. So when they did CT scans of people's chests, they did find signs consistent with pneumonia, because that's ultimately what this illness is basically a pneumonia, right? They also, in some patients, have found ground glass opacities, which they think are indicative of, once again, inflammatory changes ongoing in the lung. But really, like, it's mostly something that we look at your clinical symptoms, and then we make a diagnosis based on that, confirm it with a test for the virus. I would say the big takeaway, though, is basically that people, once they get into the critical illness state, may require mechanical ventilation for a long time. Even sometimes there have been cases where people will improve for a little bit and they'll take them off the ventilation, but then they'll deteriorate again and need to be re-ventilated. So it's looking like a lot of people may take 2 weeks or more on a vent to get them through it, which is why the shortage of vents is a big talking point we have in the modern medical picture. But hopefully we'll have enough supplies and resources to get through this, and hopefully we also have some exciting new treatments coming down the pipeline that will hope to mitigate the illness and make it so not as many people get into that rough of shape. What do you have to say about that, Dan?
All right. Yeah, so you've touched upon some of the mainstays of treatment, and it's that we don't really have any real cure right now. There's a lot of medications in trials, but right now the recommendation is mainly supportive care, symptom management. And a lot of that is going to be giving respiratory support, oxygen, positive pressure ventilation. And for the cases that do get worse, intubation, mechanical ventilation, and in some cases, even something called ECMO, which is extracorporeal membrane oxygenation. And that's when you take the blood out of the body into a machine that can then exchange carbon dioxide and oxygen. So it kind of bypasses the lungs, which in the most severe patients, as you mentioned, they're so waterlogged, essentially, that they can't really do anything. And you mentioned something else, which is that a lot of the damage being done to the lungs comes from something called a cytokine storm, the immune system response. So back when we had SARS, when we had MERS, one way of thinking was, can we control the immune system? Can we tone it down so that these immune systems aren't damaging their own organs as much? And so they would give people glucocorticoids. But after the fact, when they went back and analyzed the data, they found out that this really wasn't helping, and there was even an association that suggested this may even have been hurting the patients, which is why now, with SARS-CoV-2, COVID-19, they're saying the recommendation has been to not use glucocorticoids unless there's some other kind of comorbid condition, like a COPD exacerbation.
It's interesting.
Something else that's been said is don't use NSAIDs. And that comes from a few case reports pretty early on that said that maybe giving people NSAIDs to control their fevers might have been associated with worse outcomes, but there really has not been any clear data, no real trial showing one way or another whether NSAIDs are good or bad. But that hasn't stopped some places from saying, yeah, no NSAIDs, let's be safe. Let's stick to something like Tylenol, acetaminophen, which can break fevers and isn't an NSAID. And actually, something that's pretty interesting is some places so you can get Tylenol over the counter, and some places are sold out of it now, so everyone's stocking up on it.
Can you speak to toilet paper? No. So, are there any interesting things on the horizon?
Yeah. So, you may have seen in the news that there's a lot of drugs entering trials right now, and for those of you who are a bit more familiar with the intricacies of the pharma industry, that might seem a bit quick. Like, how can we go from there's a new virus and then to we're trialing a cure in just 1 or 2 months? And the answer is this concept called drug repurposing or drug repositioning. And that's where you think it's going to take a long time to develop something new. But what if we already have something that's maybe in development, maybe in trials, maybe even approved? And it has a mechanism that, you know, plausibly could work against this new illness. Why don't we try that first? Why don't we see if something we have in our little toolkit, our little arsenal, can be used first? And that's where all of these things that are being tested right now come from. They were developed previously for other diseases, other illnesses, and they just happen to have something about them, something about their mechanism that says, you know, maybe we can use it for COVID. And one of these mechanisms, one of these drugs that's been giving a lot of press recently, works through inhibition of the viral protease. So the viral proteases are enzymes that are made by the virus, or encoded by the virus, made by the host, that are involved in processing viral proteins into a more usable form. So they're an essential part of the virus's replication cycle. And this is the mechanism of an HIV drug combo, lopinavir, ritonavir, which was used back in the day to treat SARS and MERS, and was one of the first drugs that they tried in China to treat COVID-19. Unfortunately, this one's already failed a major trial, but it is still being tested in the WHO's new trial. It's called Solidarity, you know, and what an acronym, you know. Props to whoever twisted, you know, 10 words to be able to spell that out.
It's almost as good as that Darth Vader satellite.
But yeah, it's being tested in combination with other things like interferon beta, which is something that your cells normally release in response to viral infection to help your cells, your immune system, fight off said viral infection.
Hmm.
So we'll see how those new trials go. And this is also the mechanism that a drug you may have heard of or even used called Tamiflu, or to use the generic name, oseltamivir, which has also been used by some hospitals and is also in trials in some places.
Mm-hmm.
Another mechanism that we've got is inhibition of the viral polymerase, which is the viral enzyme that actually will engage with the viral RNA. And two strategies can be seen here. We've got nucleotide analogs, which are incorporated into the assembling virus, and then through various means terminate replication. And we also got direct inhibitors of the RNA polymerase. Now, the big name here is remdesivir, which was originally made to treat Ebola virus. And since January, it's been used in China, it's been used in Europe, it's been used in the US in a few patients. And in these case reports, it's had supposedly some benefit. And it's now being trialed, phase 3 trial in China, and it is also a major part of the Solidarity trial. There's a lot of hope around that drug. Other things in that category, we've got favipiravir. It's an anti-flu drug used in Asia. It's also had some claimed use against COVID-19, and the interesting thing about this one is that it's already had a very small clinical trial in China where they found that favipiravir was effective. But then it turns out that trial has a lot of questions about the way that it was conducted, its methodology, you know, which patients were selected, the relevance of the population to the general population. So it's something we'll have to really wait for more larger, more elegant trials to really see. And probably the most talked about drug back in February was something called chloroquine. Along with its close relative, hydroxychloroquine. These are anti-malarial agents, but they also appear to have some activity against coronaviruses through kind of a mechanism that's not quite fully understood, but it seems to have a lot of a multi-axis, you know, effect against viruses. They're saying that it might inhibit some of the pH-dependent steps in viral replication. It might prevent viral release through inhibition of autophagy and vesicle formation. It might interfere with surface receptors of the viral particle. Now, the major thing about chloroquine is that it's one of the drugs that the China's National Health Commission, that their COVID report recommends. And both chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine are now part of the WHO Solidarity trial. Interestingly, there's a small French clinical trial that tested hydroxychloroquine, and they found that it's actually very effective in reducing the nasopharyngeal viral load. And we've mentioned that that's where the virus is going to concentrate, and that's where you're going to have, you know, spread of the viral droplet of the virus in droplets. But that viral load was reduced in these hospitalized COVID patients to a level where they were undetectable. Hmm. So signs of strong potential there.
Hmm.
Now, maybe we should add a disclaimer here. These are all like early trials. Mm-hmm. Just because we think something like hydroxychloroquine looks promising, you should still go to a doctor, discuss with a doctor whether or not this is an appropriate therapy for you.
And it's, I don't think anybody in the U.S. is.
I think they're starting to try to roll out some trials in New York, but I've just heard that anecdotally. But I have heard confirmed cases of people going out, seeing things on the shelf in the back of their garage that say chloroquine on it, and thinking, I'm going to take some of this prophylactically. Yeah. Do not do that. This is serious medication. You need to have a medical professional supervising you before you do anything like this.
Talk about side effects, because isn't it with the chloroquines, you get nightmares. These
antimalaria drugs have terrible side effects.
Yeah.
And hydroxychloroquine is actually the one used in the U.S. mainly because it's the less toxic version. Not non-toxic, less toxic. So I guess those were some of the big guns right now. The ones getting the most press, the ones in attention. But there's a few other strategies that are being considered. One of them is using the blood serum, the plasma, from recovered patients, which should contain antibodies against the SARS-CoV-2. And that would essentially, and you give that serum to current patients, and the idea is the antibodies will then attack the CoV-2 in your current patients and help their immune system deal with it. And that's kind of the same principle, that is the principle of passive immunization that is used a lot in infants and in the immunocompromised.
Now, using, you might say convalescent is what it's called.
Yeah, convalescent serum is the official term.
Yeah, the movie Outbreak really explains it quite well.
Yeah.
Took
it from a monkey, though.
Yeah.
I mean, Hollywood has had so many of these movies about pandemics.
Yeah.
You know, that was a cute monkey. I can understand.
I'm glad it was immune.
Yeah. But there's also a large number of biotech companies that are kind of taking that one step further and saying, you know, what if we can make, you know, a better antibody, one that we can give to patients and kind of prophylactically give it to these patients and prevent them from getting this illness, kind of like a large-scale passive immunization program. Mm. And in terms of the timeline, we could be seeing those being used around the end of the year, whereas for active immunization, like what we think of traditionally as vaccines, those are, the optimistic timeline for them puts them out as being ready next year at the earliest.
Just any idea when we can expect a vaccine? You mentioned briefly, but is there any detailed info on that?
So the NIH has been doing a phase one trial on a possible vaccine. That trial should be wrapping up at the end of April. Now, a phase one trial is going to be mostly about safety. So is the vaccine safe to give to people, to healthy people? Mm-hmm. And does it kind of elicit an immune response in healthy people? Mm-hmm. So it's the very earliest stage. And most of the drugs that I mentioned already have kind of done this already. Like they've skipped straight to phase two, phase three.
Because they're already proven safe because they're being used for other things?
Okay. Phase two is the kind of efficacy. You go to a small population and you say, does our drug actually do what it's advertised to do? Mm-hmm. And then phase three is your comparison. And it says, now, is your drug better than nothing? Mm-hmm. And it's only really after the phase three when groups like the FDA can really say, you know, I give you my approval to sell this drug, to market it for this purpose. So some other strategies that are worth mentioning, if only for the scientific interest. So Australia actually is piloting a massive trial of the BCG vaccine. Now, that's the childhood TB vaccine that the U.S. doesn't use, but many other nations around the world do use. And they're trialing this in healthcare workers with the rationale that BCG may potentiate the immune response against other infectious diseases. And there's been some literature in the past showing that this effect might be real. So now they're trying to see if this can be used in any way against COVID-19.
Like, do they think like heterologous immunity? Like they think it's ramping up the immune system?
Something like that, yeah.
That's a fancy word.
Thank you.
And lastly, this is more related to symptom management than actually any antiviral effect, but there's also an IL-6 inhibitor out there called tocilizumab, and that's originally used for treating arthritis, but with IL-6 being an important, you know, immune mediator and the immune system being a cause of damage here, they're hoping that using this IL-6 inhibitor can improve, at least ease the disease course for these patients.
Hmm. It's also high yield for the boards.
Yeah, so overall, there's a lot of potential for something out of this massive, massive basket to be effective against SARS-CoV-2 and COVID-19. But...
Do any of you want to talk about what this, the other big thing that we hear about in terms of, I guess it's more prophylactic, of flattening the curve?
Social distancing.
Yeah.
Oh, social distancing.
Which means to use, you know, concrete terms instead of buzzwords.
Means, hashtag flatten the curve.
Yeah, it means, yeah, I'm like, what does that mean?
Hashtag 6 feet apart.
You know, an ounce of prevention is better than a pound of cure. Yeah. You know, you don't want to get to the point where your options are supportive management and then hoping to get one of these drugs that hasn't been approved yet. Like basically an experimental drug treatment at this point.
Don't want to be a guinea pig. Yeah. So basically social distancing means stay at home and only go out for essential things like groceries once a week or if you have to go to a pharmacy. But stay at home as much as you can is what that means.
One important thing to remember is that some of these people who are going to be asymptomatic. Mm-hmm. So you might have the illness, you just don't know it, but you can still spread it to other people.
Right.
And it may not be so harmless in other people.
Yeah.
For the reason that I think Carl mentioned of if anything, because there are so many asymptomatic cases and mild cases, you might think that it's going to be fine, but a lot of it is so that we don't overburden the healthcare system.
And especially for young people, like there's this persistent myth in some places that young people are not as vulnerable to this disease or even protected against the disease, and that's really not true. Young people get the disease, young people die of the disease. There's a lot of young doctors in China, in the U.S., who have fallen victim to COVID-19.
Hmm. Any other last minute or last thoughts?
I don't think so.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, okay. We hope this has been informative. Again, we are medical students, so if we are not medical doctors, and so if you have any symptoms, like really just anything that you are concerned about, call your doctor, because it's better to be safe than sorry. And
it's a tough time we're going through, but we just have to be smart, stay together, work together, look out for each other, and we'll all get through it. Yeah. You know,
all right. Signing off.